CorpoNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
This is Robert J. Schwalb, the Prince of Darkness of Gaming, and I'm here on The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 148. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I use the power of my mind to summon forth Robert J. Schwalb to talk about psionic power. Not too much news to mention these days. The Essentials products are... some of them are out, and some of them are coming out, and I'm working on some things to take a look at it and make sure we let you know what the thoughts are about those products. I'm thinking to do it in two parts instead of doing every single product separately, which would just be a little overwhelming and redundant. But that's neither here nor there. For this episode, I am looking at the book Psionic Power. It came out recently in conjunction with Dark Sun, a setting that appropriately uses psionics more than many other worlds. And a book that, for more than one hater of psionics out there, that I've heard of anyway, has saved the entire power source for many of the classes. It's worth noting, however, that this is not a review episode. The purpose of this episode is not to take a critical look at the book and make judgments on it. Rather, I got the lead designer of the book, Robert J. Schwalb, to chat with me about it and go into all the nitty-gritty details on what went into the book. If you're looking for a review, well, here's my short version. If you play a psionic character, get the book. There. Between that and the information you'll get in the episode, I guess you could call it an interview, you should be good to go. But before we get into the interview, I want to mention our sponsor, Noble Knight Games. My pick for the episode is Castle Ravenloft, the board game. This is the brand new game from Wizards of the Coast that is honestly more of a starter set for D&D than the starter set is. The rules are mostly stripped down simple version of 4th edition D&D combined with tile or exploration board game rules. It's really easy D&D with no DM, a random experience, and worst case scenario, the game pieces are unpainted D&D minis. Great for adding to your collection when you need a horde of skeletons or the like. Normally, this game runs $65, but Noble Knight has it for $52. Look for a link in the show notes.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Okay, and now I am here with Robert J. Schwalb, who wrote about 3/4 of the book, I hear?
Yeah, about that.
Okay. And you just told me before we started recording that, in fact, you wrote a whole bunch of the book that never even made it to print.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad and funny story. I started designing the book, and I kind of got carried away. And so there's an extra build for each class and probably another 400 feats. And the Paragon Path for each class, and extra epic destinies, all that stuff just had to get trimmed out because if it had been put in, we would have looked at a 320-page psionic power instead of a 160 or whatever it wound up being.
So you wrote 2 builds for each class?
Yeah, and we took the best one for each class.
So what you're telling me is that Psionic Power 2 has already been written?
Well, and it could be. I imagine if there was a demand for it, maybe I could go back and do it. Although I think, you know, I toured the psionic power source pretty heavily, so I'm almost kind of it would be a trial to go back to it, I guess.
Yeah, although with all that stuff already written, I guess it wouldn't be too difficult to turn them into a series of DDI articles as well if people want to get those builds and feats and what have you.
Right. And I think that in some, I think that that certainly has been talked about. I mean, some of the stuff obviously we cut or molded or fused in with the existing builds. And so it's not going to be quite possible to extricate some of that. But in fact, one of the builds that I did cut from the Ardent, that we did cut from the Ardent, is in queue to come out at some point in the future for DDI. I'm not sure when, but it's not a full build, but rather it's kind of a, so it's a more of a half build, if that makes any sense.
Okay. I'm sure it will when it comes out, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Good. So, just in a nutshell, Psionic Power is giving support to the Psionic classes, the Ardent, the Battlemind, the Monk, the Scion, and then it gives a bunch of extra Psionic sort of options, feats and backgrounds and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And there's a chapter dedicated to each class that starts with some role-playing advice on how to play that class and then gets into a new build and powers and paragon paths for it.
Yeah. That's, and you know, not to jump the gun, but I do want to bring highlight Ari's work on this book. Ari really took charge of the opening role-playing advice sections. He was brought in to take care of those elements and to kind of knit the book together in that sense. And because we really felt that after, I guess it was around Divine Power when we were kind of realizing that, you know, these books are really useful. They've got a lot of utility, but they're really just not a lot of fun to read. And because, I mean, they're manuals and they're meant to be used.
Right.
So with Divine Power, and it's more so in Primal Power, and then finally with Psionic Power, we've kind of recalculated how we actually handle these books. And we want to make sure that we're giving a lot of good story content to kind of frame in the mechanical content that, that pretty much this book is all about.
Okay, well let's go ahead and just go through this book piece by piece rather than speaking general about the process, since the whole episode is going to be you chatting about Psionic Power. Let's just go through it and see what you have to say about each little part of it.
Okay.
The first chapter opens up with Ardent. And like we just talked about, it opens up with role-playing advice on how to play an Ardent. So how do I do that?
Well, you know, the thing about the Ardent that the backstory a little bit. When we were working on Player's Handbook 3, I received the Ardent to design. And so I think James Wyatt or someone else had done some initial framing for the class. And then I kind of took it over the goal line, so to speak. And the thing that I really kind of figured out when designing the Ardent was that of all the Psionic classes that we have, it is the one, in my opinion, that is closest to the 3.x Psionic Warrior, Psychic Warrior. Oh. Because I feel like the Battlemind has its own shtick. But the Ardent, however, has got a whole bunch of neat kind of quirky abilities and powers that really kind of they really kind of emulate and recapture some of the tactical choices and options that were available to you in 3rd edition. So even though the Ardent is a leader, I also see him as kind of like frontline fighter guy. So role-playing these guys, I mean, these guys are the ones who wear their emotions on their sleeves, right? And it infects other people. The two core builds from the Player's Handbook 3 focused on the Elation and Clarity. And so what the Ardent's basically doing is that he gets into his unconscious ability to kind of manipulate or touch other people's minds. And so when the Ardent sees something, you can be damn well sure everyone else nearby is going to see that same thing. When the Ardent feels something, those feelings will kind of bleed off onto other people. And so I kind of see these people as high, I see these characters as fairly emotional and tend to be, and maybe and even for role playing, even react a little over the top to what would be basic kind of things. Not to the point where it's ridiculous, but I mean, I definitely sense they're not to the point of Deanna Troi, like Captain I Sent, blah, but rather more of the more aware of their surroundings and more aware of the feelings and attitudes of people around them, and maybe even adopt them for themselves. So yeah, that's kind of what I see with those guys.
Yeah, it almost just from your discussion of it, almost seems like you could play an Ardent that isn't even fully aware of his psionicness. You know, he's just a really empathic sort of person who also, you know, without knowing it, projects his own emotions onto others.
Right. And in fact, there's a sidebar in the Battlemind section. Ari or myself took care of that one. Can't remember. But it was talking about how the battle mind's not quite, hasn't quite figured out that he is a that he actually has the psionic abilities. And I think that same kind of story or role playing hook can apply to the Arden as well, as you said. And I know Ari does get into this kind of weirdness with, not weirdness, but some interesting interesting playing player hooks with Ardents and Witchcraft on page 9, where it kind of talks about how the Ardents tend to affect other people and they can be kind of persecuted for their latent abilities or their abilities they're not even aware they have. Mm-hmm. So it is a – or if they do – yeah. So I find it kind of – so those elements are certainly in place for this particular class. Yeah.
And that idea of witchcraft actually rings back to, what is it, second edition psionics, where that was one of the big balancing factors. You know, sure, psionics were more powerful, but you're considered like a witch and you're hunted down and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Luckily, we're not balancing. I mean, luckily we're not balancing mechanics on story in this edition. But I mean, I think that was kind of a cool part for Ari, a cool revelation for Ari, rather kind of a retro kind of thing cooking. Let me back up. I think it was great that Ari kind of dug back into second edition concepts to carry forward to the current edition of the game. And in fact, I try to do that, and I know Ari tries to do that in pretty much everything we do these days. We really like to throw bones to the veterans.
Right on. So we do get a new build of Ardent, the Impetuous Ardent. What is the Impetuous Ardent? Tell us a little bit about the idea behind this build.
So my thought for the Impetuous Ardent was that this is a guy who kind of shuts off his higher thinking. He doesn't really kind of see through. He doesn't see the consequences of his actions and acts pretty much on instinct. These guys, and Ardents and Battle Minds, at least in some of the initial discussions about psionic power, were to be classes that didn't always necessarily have formal training. I mean, the monk definitely comes from a monastery, and a scion definitely comes from an order or something along those lines, where there's some sort of structure behind the methods they use. But Ardents and Battle Minds, as I said, at least at some points in discussion of these classes, were always kind of thought to be the accidental psionic characters. So the Impetuous Ardent was my effort to try to take this a step forward and say, this is a guy who just, he's got temper issues or he's also rather impulsive, and he'll jump the gun and deal with whatever he has to deal with later once he's already kicked everyone's ass. The class feature of the mental impulsiveness kind of urges your allies to do the same kind of thing. The aggression is kind of shows up in the boost to endurance and intimidate checks. You also get the fact that they have the, it's also reflected in the fact that you're boosting opportunity actions by giving them a damage spike. And then also the Ardent Eruption power really talks to how when you take damage and when your emotions are at their hottest, when you're bloodied, you're going to boost everyone around you and they're going to get pissed off as well. So those are kind of some of the things that I really wanted to I think the mechanics kind of really reflect this kind of, a super aggressive, not a whole lot of kind of reflection or even or regret, and just going out and kicking butt. And that's kind of what I really want to do with this guy. And I think he's probably closer to the psychic warrior. He's probably the closest to the psychic warriors of the three builds we have.
Okay, right on. So one presumes that the idea behind most of the new powers was to support the new build. And I assume that mechanical concept of the Impetuous Ardent carries over into the new powers?
It does. When I started, as I said, I overwrote these. I think what I did was I wrote two powers for the new build, two or four powers for the new build, and I think I did one more power for every other build. As you can see, there are, I would put it at, what, seven powers, six powers? We've got four usually per level. So I know we kept one or two. We always make sure we had one or two that spoke directly to the Impetuous Ardent. I mean, for example, on the facing page, you can see Impetuous Ruin, and that is... you smack this guy, you're kind of where you're getting more aggressive, you're kind of shutting down this guy's ability to be aggressive. Because Ardents kind of are swinging, kind of run that way, where as they have an emotion that builds up inside of them, the opposite of that emotion tends to manifest in their enemies. So Impetuous Ruin, of course, is one that says, you know, I smack you and you would get to make opportunity attacks at all and for a specified period of time. And you can kind of see that. And in fact, the augment 2 just dazes the guy. So yeah, and Part the Fog, definitely a clarity thing, and Karmic Bond would fix probably. Yeah, that's going to be an Impetuous, and Waves of Fatigue would probably be, it was also maybe the Elation build.
Okay, good. So you're getting a little bit. You're definitely supporting the new build, but you're also adding in some new options for everybody else as well.
Right. In every Power Source book we do, we try to speak to existing options to make sure that everyone can use the book. The last thing you want to do is crack open a new, you know, Martial Power 75 and find out that the Resourceful Warlord's not covered or doesn't get any kind of bennies. So that's kind of a major design move that pretty much everybody at internally and freelancing is kind of driven to do.
Right on. All right, then after that, you finish off the chapter with a section on Paragon Paths. I guess rather than going through Paragon Paths, I'm curious what the approach is to coming up with Paragon Paths. I mean, I've seen some books that have, you know, just a handful, you know, maybe a couple to support each build or whatever. But you've got a good number of Paragon Paths in here.
Right. So with what have we got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So again, I wrote that there were 7 Paragon Paths when I did the initial design. We took the best 6. For when I'm doing a set of Paragon Paths, we want to make sure that we have at least 2 to 3, but at least half of them should reflect the new build. So in this case, I think 3 or 4 of them do, and the other ones kind of are either generic options or can maybe go back to a previous build. Usually when I'm doing a Paragon Path, it's kind of try to follow the same model when I do any kind of game design, which is kind of seize on a story idea first. And then once you have a story idea and it's cool and it's engaging, then you kind of tailor the mechanics to kind of reinforce that story idea. And so I really tried hard to do that in this book to make sure that, excuse me, just a second. I'm sorry. Telemarketers of the devil.
Uh-huh.
All right. So anyway, where was I? So yeah, it's reinforcing the story through mechanics. So that's on the one side. Now, on the other side, when I was doing these Paragon Paths, I'm not going to be ashamed to say that I trawled a lot of the old 3rd edition stuff and 2nd edition stuff to try to find things that kind of leapt out of the page and said, hey, this is worth bringing back. The Anarchic Adept is a good example. I think it came out of the Complete Psionic, maybe? Complete Psionic, the 2nd Psionic, well, the 3rd edition power, well, what was basically be a Power Source book.
Right.
And so what I did with that, I kind of looked at the story elements for that particular prestige class, and I kind of drew them out and figured, all right, well, what was this guy doing? And then I can go back in and plug in the mechanics that kind of fit. Now, as you can see, the Psionic classes tend to take up, their powers take up a ton more room than a standard class, because you usually have the augment lines that just eat up a lot of space.
Right.
So with like the Anarchic Depth, you don't get the arc because they were just too long. But you know, what, for example, there's Chaotic Action, which is the 11th level ability. And this is one that kind of plays around with some new mechanics and says, all right, so you spend the action points with the attack, and then the ally gets a benefit that's random. So you roll a d6 to see what happens. And so what I was really trying to do there was try to create some, to kind of stake out some new territory and try to do some Hinesu-esque type game design that I thought people would think would be interesting and engaging, at least to try out. So, of these, I think the Anarchic Adept is one of my favorites from the Paragon Paths. I do like that one a great deal. Although the Siphon is a lot, the Siphon actually kind of goes back to, was inspired by the other build I designed for the Ardent, which was an empath type character, which is the one that actually has been, I think, I distilled the idea down to a subset of powers and some feats that would support that concept. You bolt onto a regular Arden for that DD article.
Right on. All right, so there's the new stuff we have in here for the Arden. The next chapter then is the Battle Mind. How do I role play a Battle Mind?
So one of the things we talked about with Battle Minds early on was that they're very confident in their abilities, and they're going to be boastful, and they're going to be almost arrogant. I think that is almost—I think that's one extreme. I think battle minds are largely characters that draw from their own life energy mingled with their psionic power to kick butt and take names. These guys are pretty much made of steel. They can absorb all sorts of damage, and they can hit pretty freaking hard. So I think when you're role-playing that, I mean, I think there's a sense that you're gonna reflect your confidence that comes from your abilities and your personality and your interaction with other characters. And I think Ari kind of covers that fairly well. He does go into that. And he also has some sidebars to talk about it as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is the Harrier Battle Mind, this new build?
So I had, at the time when I was writing this, I had this thing for characters that could bamf around the battlefield. I totally like the super mobile teleportation things. Mm-hmm. To get that for the Battle Mind, I had to make him a little less durable. Now, he didn't sacrifice anything in hit points or that stuff, but he almost kind of harkens to, dare I say it, the Sword Mage and its ability to kind of be everywhere at once. Mm-hmm. So his Persistent Harrier ability is, one of the cool things about, one of the things I liked about the Battle Mind was that every build has a start of the round, change the game, change the circumstances with a red power. So the Speed of Thought allows you to move. That's for the quick Battle Mind. The Harrier Battle Mind lets you damage a guy and teleport around that guy to strike him again later from an undescribed direction. So this guy is pretty much defeating the enemy's expectations by being super mobile and using teleportation to facilitate his mobility.
Right on. And yeah, there's not, I mean, other than the Sword Mage, there's not a lot of defenders that typically bounce around the battlefield very often. So it's interesting to get that take.
Yeah, and it's tricky to do that too, because we want, you know, there's a big school of thought that says that defenders need to be nailed down in one spot and not move around at all. And this was my effort to try to say, well, maybe that's true for most defenders, but let's see what happens when you can actually free the Battle Mind to move around a little bit and take advantage of some movement stuff. And I think it works. Now, in this chapter, we also spoke to at least a little bit powers that when I was designing it, I was very aware of the fact that we had the Wild Battle Mind build in the Dark Sun campaign guide. Mm-hmm. So I tried to design some powers that would, if not directly support that build, at least be cool for characters that have that build. I think Lodestone Lure would be an interesting example. It's a level 3 Battle Mind power. It does sort of low damage, but you have a melee 2. You pull the target. As you boost it, you extend your reach, and then you can basically drag the guy up to you and then knock him down with the maximum augment. And Wild Savagery is another example. That's a utility 2, and it kind of talks about it. It really addresses the fury and the kind of super aggression that is built into these guys.
Okay. And then you also, I mean, I assume the same philosophy applies in terms of building powers and paragon paths, and that you've got a good mix of things to support the new build as well as existing builds. I see a lot of it's fairly easy to pick out the Harrier Battle Mind powers because they tend to have things like the teleportation keyword.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty good cue. Now, one thing you'll notice, one thing that that we have not done for many psionic powers is that we don't have like build flags or build riders that bolt onto the powers. Generally, we did it with a monk in this book, which we'll come to in a bit. But it's a little bit more. It takes a little bit. You have to kind of dissect the power to see if it's going to really fit with your build. Look for the secondary ability if it's going to kick off. And the reason why is because these are so packed full of information. That and because there are so many variables with your augments, it's easier for us to say we let the class features talk to the character in other ways rather than affecting the power design.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a concern when you add a new element to, like, for example, you got the Harrier Battle Mind, which is built to teleport around and be in all over the place in the battlefield, and that build had to make some sacrifices to be able to do that, but that build is not the only build that can take those powers and now start teleporting all over the place.
Right. Well, the sacrifices for the build are really live inside of the powers that let it teleport.
Okay.
So, like Many Door Curse, it is a level 29 Battle Mind power. Normally 29 level powers are going to do about 7 dice of damage, maybe give or take. This one's at 4 weapon damage with a half damage miss. And this guy went in while the target's in. Target takes damage from attack, you teleport it to a square adjacent to your ally, you can see the free action. So what you're basically doing is you're bamfing this guy around. You smack this guy so hard that he's kind of, he's in every time you hit him, he's going to keep popping around the battlefield. That continues until he saves. And he takes damage. He melts his brain when you teleport him as well. So he's doing less damage, but you get a really kind of interesting, you get interesting tech to play with as far as that lives in the effect line.
And I noticed that for a second there, you said you bamf around, and it made me realize, oh, that's right, this is Nightcrawler.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, I get it now. Good.
So in Paragon Paths, there are a couple in here that I'm pretty super excited about that I really want to. There's the first one is a Blackstone Guardian, and the second one is a Storm Disciple. As I said before, you know, this is my fourth Power Source book I've worked on, and that's after two Player's Handbooks. At a certain point, you know, there's only so many ways you can spend one weapon damage plus ability modifier, comma, effect, right? So this was an opportunity for me to say, I want to try to do some different things with different keywords and different conditions and take the game in directions that that people wouldn't necessarily expect. So we have, maybe it's not this one, but... Right, so we've got the aspect of the Blackstone Jailer gives you lets you petrify a target, which is pretty much the ultimate of defender abilities, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that guy's not going to go anywhere, he's not taking any actions, and he's pretty screwed pretty much until he can save. So this guy, and the Blackstone Guardian comes from it was inspired by the Blackstone Gigant from, what was it, Monster Manual 2?
Okay.
From 3rd edition? So I like the story that was kind of lived at that, and so I kind of tweaked it out a little bit to give some sort of petrification, you transform yourself into stone kind of thing. I revisit the same concept in The Monk later on. The other one is the Storm Disciple, and I'm pretty hot for this one because it lets you basically turn into a big storm. So your space grow inflates to 7 squares by 7 square areas in your space. You're insubstantial. You can occupy other creature spaces, but you can't attack. You get to slide pierce to start in your space, and then you also get to do you spike your damage and daze targets. So it's this really kind of interesting thing where it's like you become this living storm that takes over the entire battlefield. 7 by 7 is just about the entire battlefield for a standard encounter for 5 characters, right? So I mean, you're pretty much everywhere, and so that was another one of those things where it's like, well, you know, you're changing your act. You're still able to contribute to the game, but you're able to super hold down everyone that's actually fighting in the area, which I think, you know, it's another effort to try to show that these defenders are a bit different than the Paladin, the fighter.
And wasn't there a 3rd edition Storm Disciple prestige class, I thought?
Yes, there was. Although...
Was it a Realms thing?
Yeah, and it was probably reprinted in one of the complete books, too, if I remember. Yeah,
but that doesn't seem to necessarily be taking a similar approach here.
No, and I think, you know, it's maybe not in the best interest of a Paragon Path to do a totally faithful reproduction,
right?
Just because the mechanics are so different in some respects.
Okay. Yeah. All right, and then the next chapter, the 3rd chapter, deals with the psionic class that I argue isn't really psionic.
Yep.
So let's talk about the monk. How do I roleplay a monk?
So I think there's a classic approach that says you're kind of this enlightened warrior guy. And I think there's a lot of traction with that. I think the monk has cast a wide enough net now that if you want to be a street brawler that doesn't really have any discipline at all, you want to be unaligned or whatever, and not really be super focused on kind of entering this transcendent state, you could certainly be just a brawler. And I think 3rd edition kind of started that with a lot of the images of half-orc monks. I know in one of my games, we had a player who was playing I think it was Olaf Gunnarsson, who was a half-orc monk who was convinced he was a half-dwarf. And I'm waxing on about my characters in red capes. But, you know, I think that's kind of that's one of the things I really want to do is kind of push these classes out to give them a little bit more room to breathe.
Good. And so then your new build is the Iron Soul, which also sort of, I guess in some way, it goes counter to some traditional stereotypes, I guess, of monks. Because the monk is your kung fu class, and then you make a monk that specializes in using weapons.
Right. Well, so monks do have the ability to use, as written, have the ability to use weapons. Right. But looking at weapon powers, I mean, weapons just... Monk weapons are just by design inferior to a standard weapon available, or a military weapon generally. And so the hardest part with the monks, we want to make sure that monks have the ability to fight with stabs and swords or whatever else that we want to have. Yeah. But it's to make those choices appealing to a character who is going to be basically using a ki focus or to kind of power those attacks. And there's some versions, I think it was an earlier version of the monk from the Player's Handbook 3 that actually gave them weapon powers. And I think the idea just got dumped because, you know, it's just, you're doing less damage. So, and it's really hard to gauge because you say, well, we want to scale these powers up because they're doing like a D6 damage because you're fighting with clubs. Well, then what if the character decides I'm going to take, you know, weapon proficiency, full blade, and then you just opened up a world of hurt. Mm-hmm. So what we did with, the Iron Soul, we finally came to, because I think the original draft of this build was, gave the character, actually had used weapon powers, but built into the class features were ways to augment or improve the weapons themselves, and they were simple weapons. So if you fought with a spear, you'd get some cool, neat effect. If you fought with a club, the same thing. We eventually dropped that because weapon powers were going to be kind of hinky with syncing up with the existing build, so we just went with flat damage, or not flat damage, but rather we expressed damage dice in the actual powers text, but we included riders that change the powers effects based on the weapons you're using, which I think I can't find them on here, but they're on here.
So they get a kicker for using certain kind of weapons, like we've seen from other builds as well. I mean, we've seen other powers and other classes that have done similar things.
The fighter started it with Player's Handbook 1. Yeah, if you look at Stinging Nettles and Swift River Floods, they both have kickers for, I think Swift River Floods is Mace or Staff, and the other one is Light Blades and Spears. So, yeah.
Right, so it doesn't happen enough that you're necessarily going to play an Iron Soul monk who specializes in a certain kind of weapon. But, you know, there's a little kicker there that makes it nice for when you do happen to fit that role.
Right, and it does give you some. Yeah, it gives you a little bit more flavor, and I think it helps make sure the character stand out a little bit more from other guys. And this guy's secondary role is pretty much defender, and it's reflected in his Iron Soul Flurry of Blows. The target can't shift after it takes damage. If it wasn't a target that triggered attack, can't make opportunity attacks. So it kind of locks him down.
Right. Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I read that and I said, oh, this is the guy who jumps into the middle of minions and then they all fall down.
Right. Right.
Because they all attack him, and then they take damage for it.
Yep.
Which I thought was pretty cool. So yeah. So then you get into the Paragon Paths. Anything you want to talk about in terms of Paragon Paths for monks?
Yeah, the Basilisk Fury Adept I was pretty happy with. That was the one that... Oh, yeah, Basilisk Nature Defense. Turns you... It's a very situational power, but, you know, if you get hit enough, you'll go unconscious. And it is a daily power, but... I want to try to experiment with powers that you take conditions on yourself, and then you get a benefit for taking that condition. So, like, you become petrified instead of being unconscious or stunned. But it's something similar with that in the Malediction Invoker in Divine Power. Uh-huh. He has a lot of really nasty powers that oppose conditions on himself. This is a monk the Paragon Paths for the monk I've always felt were kind of weird because... I think because it's pretty much wide open, right? I mean, you figure you're going to be, I'm a mystic warrior. I'm focused on my mind. Where is it going to take you as far as how will your character develop? And so the Basilisk Fury Adept is one of those guys. It's kind of like, well, here's this kind of strange kind of evolution of one fighting style that maybe monks might embrace. Some of the stuff here, of course, is certainly old school. Like Four Winds Master was inspired by the monk from the first edition AD&D Player's Handbook. So it's got all the east, north, south, and west winds. Soaring Blade is my gives you, kind of creates a monk who fights with a I think a heavy blade. Yeah. So, and I thought that, and that, cause I think there's kind of something kind of sexy about an unarmed guy, an unarmored guy, especially an Eladrin or an elf that's kicking butt with a long sword and is all over the place. I like, that's a cool image for me.
It's kind of a classic image.
Yeah.
And there's other classes that can do it, but it's interesting to do it as a martial artist, you know?
Right.
Cool. Well, we go from, I recently ran a poll on one of my other websites, Temporary Hit Points, which is for D&D players. And according to that poll, we're now traveling from the most fun playable class to the least fun playable class with the Scion.
Yep.
So let's talk about how to role play a Scion, and then we'll figure out what you did in here to make the Scion fun again.
Well, the Scion, of course, is going to be it's a counterpart to the wizard. These guys are part of old and ancient established traditions. They have a very methodical way of approaching the power source. I think that they are also characters that are pretty much super specialized. So, I mean, you could diversify and go telepathy or telekinesis or shaper, but the idea is that your character is going to be, you know, if you're going to be one route, you pretty much are that guy. And I think those things, your power decisions and feat choices can really kind of reinforce your character concept quite a bit. But I think really tying them to an order is a way to make them interesting, because it gives you a society or an organization that you can pull, that the DM can then pull into play.
All right, good. So then you get into the new build here, and it's funny, one of my players is the big LFR guy, right? And so he's around a very different sort of group of players on a regular basis, because you have a different type of play in a game like that than you do in an ongoing campaign sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And he came from LFR one week and said, you know, I've decided that psionics are the most boring mechanic in the game, you know, because you're just constantly using the same powers over and over again. You might augment them, but it's still the same powers. And then he came back the next week after psionic power had come out and said, okay, never mind, the Scion is cool again. So what did you do to make the Shaper Scion so cool that you changed his mind?
I didn't. I'm sorry. You dropped out on me there after you said, so I lost you after you said he came back the next week.
Okay, he came back the next week after psionic power had come out, and all of a sudden he says that psionics are awesome again, and he really wants to play a Shaper Scion. So what did you do to make the Scion cool again?
I think, first of all, I recognize the fact that the telepath and the telekinetic Scion builds are tricky to pull off, and it can feel like you're mashing the same button, so to speak. I think with the Shaper Scion, when I was working on this one, I confess that my favorite class to play is the Shaman. I like being in two places at the same time. I like that kind of that dynamic at the table. So I wanted to give, and there's a legacy of the Snot and Crystals Scion guy from third edition. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of look back at that just a little bit and say, here's a guy that can use an ectoplasm and create some cool and interesting creatures and effects. So shape consciousness, I think, is really what makes this really is a sexy option, because it does allow you to be in two places at once. You can make attacks using your shape, your conjuration space as the origin for the attack. You can stay in one spot, move your consciousness around the battlefield, and blast everybody you want until it finally disappears. After that, you're still relatively fresh and you're able to participate and do what you normally would do. The Shaper Scion also is very much focused on summon creatures, and summon monsters are very tricky to pull off, as I've seen again and again, but mainly because it's like, well, unless you have a special rider that bolts onto the power, you just got to pretty much, all you're doing is controlling your servant. So we try to do some interesting things with the summoning, but we didn't want to overshadow the wizard summoning either. And plus, with the power selection in this book, I really wanted to kind of, again, push against the boundaries and create some more room to do some interesting and strange things. For example, Dimensional Scramble. It's an area burst one, all creatures, does low damage, but you teleport the target to a square adjacent to the burst. Not too many powers do that, and what I'd want to do is kind of say, this is a very much kind of almost reckless controller type thing that allows you to reshape the battlefield, mm-hmm. In an interesting way, at least. And again, we'll see. And also with Living Missile, which is their power, I'm very happy with. What I did here was this is a power that you grab a guy with telekinesis, and then you can throw him around the battlefield, which and turning him into a weapon, which I thought was kind of fun.
Yeah, and that's kind of that's as much as anything, I guess, is iconic in terms of psionics. That's sort of an iconic concept, you know, picking up things or people and throwing them at each other.
It's super fun.
Right on. And I really liked, I mean, I played a Scion back in third edition. Now I can tell you about my character.
Oh, good.
And my favorite way to build a Scion in third edition was to go with the summoning Scion, you know, the one that pulls up the ectoplasm and then can shape it into, you know, one of half a dozen different shapes that he's sort of specialized in.
Yep.
You know, and I look forward to seeing how this shaper build sort of plays into that old nostalgia that I have.
Some of the things with really the way we were able to handle kind of, well, maximum flexibility with summon monsters was one of my first goals for this particular build. Space concerns and balance concerns made me back away from that.
Sure.
So what we did was kind of like the same kind of thing we've done with a lot of summon creatures, is that we create a one variety, and then with this case, you can modify it by augment by dumping more power points into it. So I think, so like summon Ebony Stinger, if you want to improve this guy's ability to grab folks, you just drop a power point, and now your enemy's going to take a -4 penalty to checks to break the grab. And we kind of repeat on this stuff in every one of these summon powers has an augment, which at least makes it different and more interesting than just a summon goblin.
Right on. And now in the psionics, or I guess in the paragon paths for a scion, you've brought back quite a few sort of old chestnuts from the past. You know,
I totally did, yeah.
I recognize a lot here with the alienist and the thrall herd is sort of a classic concept of I'm just going to start forcing, you know, bending people's will to my own and forcing them around.
When I started this book, there were two paragon paths I knew I was going to do, and I wasn't going to budge. And that was the alienist and the thrall herd. I wasn't really sure how I was going to do it when I started, but I knew that they had to be in this book because, gosh darn it, the alienist was my favorite prestige class from third edition, and he had to come back somewhere. Firestarter was also another one that was a very classic, is another old school thing. And I think it's kind of interesting because I like it a lot because it allows you to change your character every once in a while, in a sense that you get this nifty neato melee 2 fire attack that does buckets of damage, which does a lot more damage than a normal 11th level power would do. Or I'm sorry, a normal first level power would do. And it gives you a little bit of controller effect and makes sure you keep the bad guys away. And the DM doesn't have to worry about this thing coming out to play all the time because you have to it triggers on a critical hit. So it's one of those things that says, well, here's a way my character can develop every once in a while and do something kind of cool. And we offset this by letting you tailor your other powers by adding fire or swapping out fire for force and giving powers that you can use a little bit more frequently than some other power paragon as well. Let's see, there's some stuff I want to. Yeah, so the alienist was one that was, again, it was my favorite prestige class because it's so weird and everyone knows everyone pays attention to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So in this case, I really wanted to. So, like the insane action feature has a random effect when you blow an action, when you spend your action point. And, you know, you could roll a one and you're dazed, but there are three really good options. So it's one of those things where it's like, do you risk it? Well, of course you do because you're nuts and you're summoning aliens. So, yeah.
And it plays in really well to the fourth edition story of psionics in terms of it being connected to the Far Realm.
Right. Because you're a deviant. If you're a scion who goes into the alienist, then you're a deviant scion, which is, I think we need to add a little bit more darkness to our paragon paths anyway.
Yeah, right on. Well, it's nice to have some paragon paths that are very much focused on that kind of a story. And Thrall Herd, you must have really enjoyed because it got double space.
Yeah, it was a paragon path that just wound up being so we knew we wanted to do it, and the developers who I was working with very closely as we were going through the book we're like, yeah, we got to do this too. But it was one of those things where it's like it's going to take up a whole lot of room. So we sacrificed the Paragon Path to do it. But I think the effect is worth it because it is a quintessential third edition psionic concept. You know, the Thrall Herd was from the book, but more importantly, it gives you a pet as a scion, and I think I think every class or power source needs some sort of pet to compete.
Right. So the Thrall Herd Paragon Path is the way that psionics gets, you know, the animal companion sort of thing.
Right. But your animal companion can also be it can be the dog, but it can also be the prostitute you picked up the night before.
Right on.
Maximum variation.
Or I always like the idea of doing the halfling Thrall Herd riding around on the back of an ogre.
Yeah, that works really well too. Yeah, yeah. So this is one of those. This was a really tricky Paragon Path because it requires a lot of extra rules that we normally wouldn't put into one of these.
Right.
That big box of text talks about your stats and how to control it. Luckily, a lot of that groundwork was done with the Beastmaster Ranger, and so we were able to pretty much kind of refine that down to some basic stuff and give you enough to run with. But I think it's got a lot of great role-playing opportunities in this too, because your thrall can, you know, it could be mindless, but it also might have these flashes of trying to break free that the DM can use to kind of drive a story.
Well, it also gives you a pretty big gray area for a group of people that are normally heroes, because you've now taken somebody and bent them to your will and forced them to do what you want to do, and that's a pretty, that's a pretty gray area, you know?
Yep. It would be really kind of interesting if actually you beat the villain at the heroic tier villain at the very end, and then when you take your Paragon Path, you turn him into your thrall. That'd be pretty sweet. That's like 20 levels of vengeance.
Yeah. Right on. All right, and then you get into the last chapter, which is all about your psionic options, which is normally where you find, you know, all the extra little crunch, like your feats and your backgrounds and all that kind of stuff, and you get all that here. But you start off by actually digging into something that's more fluffy than it is crunchy. It's specifically fitting the concept of psionics into some of the various campaign worlds. Some of them, you know, for example, psionic power in Athas doesn't need much explanation, right? Because psionics are integral to both Athas and Eberron. And then Forgotten Realms, you have to maybe wiggle a little bit more to make it fit. But psionics have been around long enough that the concept of psionics has already sort of been fit. So talk a little bit about the idea of fitting psionics in this section here into the various campaign settings.
This was a section that Ari took point on. We knew that we wanted to have a little. One of the problems that we've had from the very start was that some of the most important power sources were not really well grounded into the setting. Divine power is easily done because it's both you. It's tied so close with the gods, and the gods, of course, are integral to D&D. Martial power is a little bit more nebulous, but arcane power really is kind of like this big question mark. And there have been various efforts made to kind of explaining how it fits into the cosmology, but we didn't want to go that way with the psionic power source. And with primal power, it has such a great and sexy story. And I think the psionic power source does as well. So we kind of want to run... So we know what the expected story for psionics is, but we want to put it through a filter so you can shine it onto the other settings. And so Ari worked with Bruce Cordell, Rich Baker, and James Wyatt to kind of talk with them about how psionics fits in those settings and kind of blow it out a little bit and to give you some guidance to players and DMs alike. You know, and building on that, to kind of reinforce the idea that we're trying to develop more of the power source in the setting, we go into a fairly heavy detail on the philosophies and orders that follow it.
Yeah, right on. So let's go ahead. Well, and I found it funny that there's a, you know, the psionic power in Athas section, makes it in there. And the book came out, what, simultaneously with the release of Dark Sun?
Right. Because, I had already finished my work for Dark Sun before I even started this book. Okay. So
when did you have time to sleep?
Yeah, really. Well, the trick with Sonic Power was that we had moved its position in the schedule. So, well, they had moved its position in the schedule, so it was pushed forward. So, and I think, I guess I was to make room for the Essentials books that are coming out this month. So it was one of those instances where it's like, Rob, we need you to come in and really knock this book out fast. And so Dark Sun certainly freshed my mind, and I knew what mechanics were surviving in the setting. But it really, while I was working on this one, Dark Sun was going through its initial development round, so it was still fresh on everyone's minds.
Right on. So then you get into this this section that isn't always – we haven't seen in all the Power Source books here, with philosophies and orders, where it's not just, you know, a background, although having the option of a background is in there. But it's more than that, and it's this idea of this organization or this philosophical concept. So I guess talk a little bit about what you built here in this philosophies and orders section.
So this is another one of Ari's sections. We had this initial discussion about this book, which we wanted to make sure that a good chunk of it dealt with story content. And so philosophies and orders were elements that appear in the Player's Handbook 3. We hint at them a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so it's an opportunity for us to blow them out. Organizations are interesting for me because I'm not sure, I mean, I'm going to be honest, I'm not sure how they fit at the game table. I think they're evocative, and they can tell you a lot about the world and the characters that are involved, related to it. It's also really good to kind of, for their DM ideas. But unless everybody's a member of the same organization, it's going to be tricky to see if that's kind of pulled into play. Unless or the organization is kind of fade in the background and it's just part of your character concept. So what we did here was kind of try to blow out these basic, not these basic, but rather these major philosophical and psionic trends in a kind of the core points of light world, and figure out how different civilizations or societies view psionics and how that's informed their cultures. And so we kind of see that in obviously we're gonna have the Fist of Zuokin. That's crucial because that kind of has that has legacy. But we also do some new stuff, I believe, like the Keepers of the Eternal Sun might be new, and the Path of the 37 Obstacles. And so essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to give characters, players, some story content to help ground them. Because Sonic class, especially like the Ardent and the Battle Mind, they don't have 30 years of baggage to kind of carry them forward. The only things we know about these characters are the stuff that we put in this book in PH3. And so I think these types of entries are really demonstrative of what these characters do in the world. So, yeah, I think they're important.
Yeah, and they're interesting. They allow you as a player to add some more depth, if nothing else, to the world, because if your DM says it's okay to use it, then you're adding an organization to the campaign setting, that whatever you're playing in.
Right.
You've also got a short section on the origin of psionics, as well as a section on giving us some more psionic backgrounds, a lot of which fit into, you know, a psionic background for each of the races that we have. But we are going a little bit long on time, so I want to go ahead and jump to some other things, if you don't mind. Unless there's something in there that you really want to chat about.
I think they cover themselves.
Okay, good. But what the next section, then, you do get into something that is a little bit more, I guess, brand new for us, and that's the idea of these psionic bloodlines.
Yeah, I am very excited these made it in the book. When I was doing design work on PH3, I had designed the Elan and the Fallowborn for that book, but they were cut for space reasons. Actually, I think they were cut to make room for the Shardbind. So what we decided to do here, I wanted to bring back at least one race from the Expanded Psionics Handbook, and I thought the Elan was the sexiest of the ones provided. And I mean, I know that the Dwaga are out there, and the half giants live in Goliath now, but the Elan was one of those. This is an original race for that book. I think it has enough legs to bring it forward. So how these work is that they function as normal races, but you bolt on a feat. You use your first level feat to gain access to all their goodies. And then once you get the bloodline, then you can take more feats and they qualify for the Paragon Path. And so what it allows you to do is that these transform your base race into something else. So you could be an elf who chooses the Elan feat, and then you are now an Elan elf that has a bunch of extra cool stuff at the cost of one feat. And if you want to further invest in that, you just take more feats, which gives you yet another branch to kind of customize your character in a really kind of neat way. So the Elan, of course, is a legacy race, and these guys are all about this kind of enlightened order that are trying to that recreate body. They take the mental essence and install it into a body crafted from pure psionic energy. And so the idea with this character is that you were chosen for whatever reason by this organization, the Elans, and elevated to their higher life form. The Fallowborn, however, really it shows my Warhammer Fantasy roleplay a heritage, because it lets you basically take it. And I had really wrestled with how I wanted to handle those mutations. I know we had some of the aberrant feats and the Lords of Madness from 3rd edition, and I really wanted to kind of talk and play with those a little bit, but I realized that rather than having a whole laundry list of weird class features that people may or may not take, it was just easier to handle through backgrounds. And so you could spin out whatever mutation you want, and as long as it has an associated skill, it can work. So you might have vestigial wings, and they give you a background access to acrobatics, for example. Mm-hmm. So this set of backgrounds kind of play with that, give you a sample selection. But I would highly encourage anybody to come up with even stranger mutations.
Right on. And I found it to be an innovative thing to mess with races in that way. It's not something we've seen a lot of. I mean, we've seen a little bit, you know, with some of the heritage feats and what have you, but
right.
This really seems to take it to a different level, where you're not just tacking something onto a race, you're actually combining this with a race and creating a new race.
Yep. Yeah, we've done it with there was a vampire race, and then I think I've done two winning races articles that kind of messed around with it a little bit. Yeah. But this is the first time we're actually able to get into an actual printed product.
Right.
So I'm pretty happy. Well, we may have done it with a vampire in the Dragon Magazine annual. Never mind. So,
sure.
Yeah, so exciting.
Good. And then after that, that's when you get into your section on feats. And I assume a lot of the feats are there not only to add new options, but also to support all the new builds and powers that we've got that we're introducing in this book.
Right. You see the expected kind of, aside from the expected types of feats that are going to modify class features and give or show what happens when you put a race and a class together. We also introduced a new type of feat called augment feats, and these give you new ways to spend power points. So if you're tired of just pushing the same, you know, if using the same kind of one power, there's, I think, like Beguiling Torment, for example, whenever you daze or stun an enemy using a sonic power, you can spend one power point to slide it any one square. These are usually simple riders that you'd bolt onto or to all of your sonic powers, but we carry this idea through the magic items at the very end of the book, too.
Right on. So it's yet another way of taking the concept of the Scion who's doing the same thing over and over again and giving him yet another option to do that same thing but do it differently.
Right. It's all about trying to increase flexibility.
So your Scion may not have the breadth of different powers that another class does, but they can do a lot more different things with the powers they have.
Right, but provided that you invest in the appropriate feats, of course, or the magic items. Right. But at the same time, I mean, I think that a lot of the concerns about Scions, especially at the low level, kind of fade once you start building an arsenal. I think they get a little more versatile as far as what they can do.
Sure, right on. All right, and then from there you get into Epic Destinies and equipment. Besides what you've already talked about with equipment, anything else you wanna mention in there?
I was very excited to see that my Grandmaster of Flowers Epic Destiny made it into the book. I'm glad I wasn't the one that was cut. This originates from the First Edition Player's Handbook, and it was a capstone level for the class. So I wanted to kind of bring. I thought it was a necessary. We had to do it. The other ones kind of talk about the story for Sonic Power Source. And if you want to play Doctor Who, you can pick the Master of Moments, Epic Destiny.
Right on. So here's my. I think this is the first time I've had a really good opportunity to ask this in terms of Epic Destinies. Do you design Epic Destinies to help the character exit the story of the campaign? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, yes and no.
I mean, there are some Epic Destinies that seem to do that really well, right? And it thoroughly explains why that character isn't out there adventuring and saving the world anymore. And then there are some that we've seen that it's and he goes off to become that character goes off to become a teacher, and it's like, well, why are they teaching? Why don't they go keep saving the world? You know?
Right. Yeah. The Epic Destinies are kind of they may be the hardest thing to design in the game, and I think the reason why, at least for me, is that I don't have a whole lot of practical experience with the Epic tier. I know the math and I know the mechanics behind it, but trying to wrap my head around what that play experience is like without having, you know, empirical data to kind of to turn to is tricky. That said, when I design an Epic Destiny, like, for example, take the Topaz Crusader. This guy's destiny is he's going to leap into the far realm and take the war to the Elder Evils living there. That is quite the end.
Right.
There's no way your character's coming back. End of story. Grandmaster of Flowers, however, you know, he could be a teacher. But he's also found, but the assumption is that he's found there's nothing more he can do himself, and it is duty to pass on or he's actually reached such a state of mind that the concerns of the world around him kind of are just really unimportant to him or whatever. It's going to be one of those things where it's like, I think an Epic Destiny should give you the exit, but at the same time, I don't think, yeah. So Epic Destiny should be built with an end state in mind. I'm thinking ahead, to other source books, but
feel free.
Yeah. But I think that also the Epic Destiny itself is telling you the story. Your period when you're in that Epic Destiny, you're going through the most important part of your character's career. This is where you get your name chiseled in stone, and you add to the great, to whatever legend, or you become a legend. And I think that becoming a legend is a significant enough endpoint without having to do something bizarre or fantastic. I mean, I did a whole article on DDI covering Planar Epic Destinies. I guess it came out a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a Prince of Hell and one legend turned into a Primordial or something like that. And, you know, all of those definitely had endpoints in mind because I thought about how I wanted to have what would your endpoint be based on the planes you're going to. That makes sense. But some classes is really kind of – it's difficult. If you're doing a fighter, for example – how many different ways do you want to spin fighter as an Epic Destiny? I mean, there are different mechanics you could certainly use, but the endpoint is going to be the same if you're a spear fighter or if you're a longsword fighter, I guess. So I think it's kind of a balance. It really goes back to, do you have a concrete idea first? And if you have a story in place and built as part of the story design, you should be considering how that character leaves. That's why we have a little immortality section.
Right. Very good. All right. Well, I think we've done a pretty thorough discussion here of Psionic Power, and I think hopefully people get an idea of what's in there and why it's there. So thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and if people want to keep up with you, can they go to, robertjschwab.com?
They most certainly can. I'm going to be silent for the next couple of days, but I'll be back and posting every day in about a week.
So you post an article almost every day then, huh?
I have since Gen Con, I've posted an article every day except today.
That has to be exhausting.
Yeah, because it's an extra 2,000 words. I wasn't planning to write every day.
All right. Well, people can check you out over there, and it'll be linked in the show notes. Thanks again.
I appreciate it, man.
Instead of summarizing the lengthy details that we got into with Robert here, I'm going to leave you with a question from a listener who called into the Tome's Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME.
Yes, I had me a question about that their new Psionic Power book. See, I got my pickup stuck in the ditch, and I tried to lift it out telekinetically, but it was stuck in there pretty good. And so I was just wondering if there's any good utility powers in that their Psionic Power book that I could use so I don't have to call AAA. So if y'all could address that, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks very much. Much obliged.
And the answer is, wait, is that your truck? Get it off my yard, you jerk. I'm calling the cops. Well, in any case, that's episode 148. I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games, and our guest, Robert J. Schwab, for taking the time out of his extremely busy schedule to talk to us. You can find his regular articles and more on his own website at robertjschwab.com. Email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com. And don't forget to call the Tome's Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. And coming up in the near future, we will be talking about the Essentials line. So let us know what you think about Essentials or what questions you have about Essentials. And we, you know, the Red Box, Heroes of the Fallen Lands, the Dungeon Tiles dungeon set, and what's the fourth one? Oh, the Rules Compendium. So if you got questions on any of those things, please send them on ahead and we'd be happy to chat about them. Also, don't forget to review the show on iTunes and tell people about it. Help spread the word. That's how the show grows. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found on the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 148, where I have called forth the deep primal emotions of Robert J. Schwab to further delve into the details of psionic power in this episode of The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.